Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, not Steve Bertrand. I'm in for him today and tomorrow, and he will be back with you next week. We have a big show for you today. Lots of things to discuss. We're going to be talking about an international women's solidarity campaign that's happening at Paper Source, and we're going to be talking about millennial home buyers. But the first half of the show, we are talking with Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter over at Cranes and regular contributor to this program. Hello. Welcome back.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Always good to see you and talk with you and get the inside scoop on what's going on here.
Thank you.
And you have so many, you are a writing machine. I feel like every time I look at your Twitter feed, there's four new pieces that you've written in the last hour.
That's what they pay me to do, is to crank them out.
you're good. All right. So there's a lot of stuff going on. Your series about where to buy right now is a really interesting one. And what is that today? Where should we be looking at real estate?
Today, so it's a 6-week series, and today it's Bronzeville and Forest Park. We've done Libertyville, we've done Park Ridge, Edison Park. We have more coming in the next few weeks, but Bronzeville, you know, I mean, Bronzeville is such an amazing story because it's been trying to come back for quite a while, and almost everybody you talk to talks about preserving that great history that it has, which I think is wonderful, because a generation ago, if Bronzeville had redeveloped, nobody would have said that. It just would have been, let's, you know, pave over all that great history, not in a literal sense, but and it's just so great to see it happen, you know, because so many people have roots there. Bessie Coleman, Ida Wells, Gwendolyn Brooks, and others. And so to see single-family homes being built and graystones being revitalized and see the neighborhood really becoming a piece of downtown again, I think is sort of important. And a lot of people are buying over there. There's been so much buying that the pressure is sort of, it used to be that everybody was buying east of King Drive, and now you're having to go west of King Drive to get the bargains.
Indeed. There's another piece that you have written recently that is really, really interesting about Chicago and how here in Chicago is the widest racial gap in home ownership, which is disappointing. I expect better of Chicago, but here we are.
It is. You may expect better, but you're not terribly surprised to see that figure, right?
Right.
I mean, everybody I talked to when those numbers came out said, yeah, that's sort of what you would expect, including the people who did the study, the Urban Institute in Washington. They were looking at 100 metros, but I took it down to the top 10. And if you look at the gap between the percentage of households that are white, I'm sorry, the percentage of white households that own their home and the percentage of black households that own their home. White households, it's about 79%, and black households, it's about 35 percentage points below that, which is a very large gap. It's a few hundred thousand homeowners missing on the black side of the equation. That's bigger than the gap in any other major city. New York is right behind us, just a little better than we are, but what this really means is that black homeowners are missing out on the stability, the building of household wealth, and the other things that homeownership provides. And one of the things that somebody said to me is that it's sad in part because Chicago was a great place for black middle-class homeownership when we were really that industrial powerhouse we were, and we had so many middle-class jobs. And I don't have the figures for 30 years ago, but the idea is that a far larger proportion of black households would have owned their home then than do today.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next, is how has that been tracking over time, and what is it forecast to do?
In recent years, it's fluctuated a bit. But in the past decade, or I guess now it's really 12 years since the housing crash, both white and black homeownership has dropped in Chicago. And interestingly, at about the same rate, about 6 percentage points less now than in 2006. But of course, whites started at a much higher level, so the drop doesn't affect it quite so much. But there were about 41% of black households owned their homes a decade or more ago, and now it's about 35%.
And as Urban Institute was doing this reporting and looking at all this information around all these metro areas, was there any sense of change on the horizon or any groups that are working to change that and equalize it a bit?
There are some. That study was just looking at the numbers, although other parts of the Urban Institute do work on other things. But there are groups like the Dearborn Realtors Board, which is Chicago's branch of the Black Real Estate Professional Association and the oldest in America, an important group. They've got some housing counseling and development programs going on. They're sort of trying to remind black families about the value of homeownership wealth. And there are also a lot of other programs through neighborhood housing services and others who are sort of trying to say, you know, homeownership really does value or does help your family's bottom line.
We are talking with Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation and take a look at the upcoming vote on rent control. Very important topic on a lot of people's minds, and that vote is just around the corner. So more on that in just a bit here on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand on 720 WGN.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand. He'll be back with you next week. I'm here today and tomorrow with you. And right now, we have our friend Dennis Rodkin in the studio with us. He is the real estate reporter over at Crain's Chicago Business, regular contributor to the show, and always a joy to have on with us. And we've been talking about real estate, of course, and homeownership and some really interesting issues surrounding it. And one, Dennis, that I know is on a lot of people's minds right now is the upcoming vote on March 20th that's going to affect rent control.
Yeah, you know, Illinois is in such an odd position because since 1998, we have had a prohibition against rent control at the state level. And so what people have been saying in the past 3-5 years, we've had a lot of anti-gentrification battles or gentrification struggles. We've had a lot of rent increases in both neighborhoods that are changing due to gentrification and longtime working class neighborhoods. So this vote is really very arm's length. It would not bring in rent control, and it would do is be a voice vote or have your say on whether there should be a state mandated ban on rent control. It's an advisory referendum. It's in 9 wards. It's in about 4% of the precincts in the city. So it's a small number of people voting. They are mostly in precincts where there have been some struggles over rent increases, and they'd simply be saying to their aldermen, to their legislators, we think it's time to look at returning the question of rent control to local control. Then if that were to happen in Springfield, then Chicago and other municipalities would look at whether to adopt rent control. So it's sort of the first step along a long process, but it has really come to that fore because there have been in Pilsen, in Humboldt Park, several parts of the South Side, there have been concerns that rental housing is spiking, or the cost of rental housing is spiking.
And do you get a sense of what, I know I'm asking you to kind of speculate, but do you get a sense of what this vote might reveal? Because there's so much activism going on.
Right.
You're having like the Lift the Ban Coalition and all these groups that are doing this work. Do you think that the needle's going to move?
Well, so that's the thing. Most of the precincts where this, again, it's only about 4% of the precincts mm-hmm. in the city, and they are places where a lot of these issues have mattered. They are places where precinct captains, aldermen, and that sort of thing might be on the side of lifting the ban. Not that we know that they are. So it seems to me pretty likely that this will be probably come in with a majority in favor of lifting the ban. But again, it's a majority of a teeny tiny minority, 4% of the city.
Right, right. It's really just this temperature check.
Yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Where are we
That's
thinking? What are we thinking about right now?
Right.
And then if that were to be the case, what would be the next steps to move that along?
Well, there's legislation in Springfield already to lift the ban, lift the statewide ban, and that's really what the next step would be. This is kind of trying to put some wind behind that, some energy behind that. And if Springfield then were to lift this legislation, then all municipalities, and one thing several people have said is there are problems in Chicago, but there are problems in Springfield and Decatur and other places and suburbs of Chicago that could be potentially helped by instituting rent control. So each municipality would have to start deciding whether to. And, you know, if that becomes a debate in Chicago, it's going to be fiery.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people. One thing to keep in mind is most economists say that rent control does not accomplish what rent control fans, or I should say rent control supporters, believe it will, but current day rent control supporters say, well, yeah, but that's looking at past systems. We can create a new one. So, I mean, it really is sort of opening the proverbial can of worms. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see the aftermath of that vote. Indeed, moving to the complete other end of the spectrum, people that do not worry about rent at all, people that have quite a bit of money. Another story that you have taken a look at lately, Steve Harvey had a condo in Trump Tower that has recently sold for $8 million.
There's another one that I believe closing today. I may have news tomorrow of another very high closing in the Trump building. And so there are a couple of good things going on, a couple of interesting things going on there. This is one that Steve Harvey rented for years. So it's like a piece of celebrity real estate, but he doesn't have a piece of it. He was a renter and it sold recently. And then if this other one comes in, I believe today or tomorrow at a very high price, what it's going to do is potentially change the news that I reported in January, which was that condos at Trump were selling at far lower prices per square foot than they were prior to his presidency. In 2017, the full year, essentially, of his first full year of his presidency, prices dropped considerably. Also, a lot of properties were taken off the market because things weren't selling there. But these two may pull that number back up. So it's possible, it's only March, but it's possible that at the end of this year, we'd be saying, yeah, that was a blip, and it may or may not have had nothing to do with his presidency. These two, this one sold for, I think, about $1,100 a square foot, which is nearly twice what the average was in the building in 2017.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have wondered what in the world his election to his presidency might have done to the real estate in that building. I've been very curious.
Well, far fewer units sold in 17 than in any prior year going back a few. And again, the price per square foot, which is easier to calculate for condominiums than for houses, because sure, condominiums tend to look more alike, dropped considerably in 2017. That's not my data. It's data from an organization that tracks these things. And it was quite a drop compared to almost any peer building in the city where prices per square foot rose. And you can read into it whatever you want. I'd rather just say the data tells you this.
Right.
But it is true that 2017, the first year that Donald Trump was president, there was a big bump down in prices in the building.
Sure. Very, very interesting. Well, we'll have to check back in later in the year and see what this year has done.
Even later this week, depending on what sells today.
That's true. Well, we will keep an eye on your Twitter feed and on Crane's Chicago Business to see what the latest is. Thank you so much, Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter at Crane's, for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today and tomorrow. He'll be back with you next week. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your afternoon with us, of course. Plenty to do still here on the second half of the show today. Lots of things to talk about here in just a little bit. We're going to be talking about millennial home buyers and some very creative solutions to accessing that down payment, but some things to look out for when doing so. But right now we're joined by phone by Winnie Park, who is the CEO of Paper Source, a paper and gift retailer that I'm sure you're familiar with, to talk about an international women's solidarity campaign that Paper Source has going on right now. Hi, Winnie. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to talk with us. So tell us about this campaign that you have going on at Paper Source for women's solidarity initiatives.
Absolutely. Well, the brand has always been about equality and really empowerment for women. And so it's really natural for our brand to support and to celebrate the continued journey for gender equality. And March 8th is actually International Women's Day. The month of March is Women's History Month. So, you know, part of our background is that we're actually serve women here in our headquarters in Chicago. 75% of our leadership team is female. The brand was founded by a woman and has always been run by a woman for the past 35 years. All of our Chicagoland sales managers are women, over 80% of our customers are women. So this is something that we really believe in, and it's something that's part of our culture. And as part of our campaign, what we want to do is just raise awareness and provide support, but really do it in a paper source way.
Right. Well, that's, I want to stop and really note those numbers again, because there are really not that many companies that can speak to numbers like that. 75% of current leadership and all sales managers in Chicago, all female. That's really remarkable right now.
It is. It's really amazing. We also have an all-female design team. And our field leadership, actually out managing stores across the country, are also 80% female. So it is something that has just been part of our culture. And I think that, you know, serving a customer base that's over 80% female, it's really wonderful that we have leaders who really intuitively get that customer. And it's just an important part of what we do.
Certainly. So tell us about this campaign and what customers could expect in stores right now.
Absolutely. So what we're trying to do is actually a couple of things. First, when customers come into the store, they're going to see that we've brought a lot of these empowerment messages together in terms of very unique product. And we've brought it together in a place, in a way that's really truly paper source. There's some wit and whimsy to it. And what we're trying to do is really financially support female entrepreneurs and makers. What's really neat about paper source is that the product is sourced from brands and vendors that are small, and many of them are up and coming. And some of them, actually, we've kind of grown up with them, and they're much bigger. But we've got brands and makers like Anna Bond at Rifle Paper Company. We've got a lot of product coming from Seltzer Goods, which was started by a woman named Gay Lamb. And then also Chicago's own Ebony Snow Herr, who is the founder of Snow and Graham, wonderful artist, studied at the School of the Art Institute, Chicago, and has really been a paper source person, followed us, bought with us, and now we're really proud to feature her work. So again, financially supporting female entrepreneurs and makers by featuring their product. The second piece is we design a lot of product with inspiring sayings and really thought-provoking sentiments. We have a series of product that really, it's whimsical. It features a mermaid and has a saying, strong women make waves. We've got sayings like girls just want to be CEO. And I think that, you know, with only 5% of U.S. CEOs as women, we're really just trying to inspire people and especially women and girls to consider options and to consider a much broader role, both in terms of business but in society. The final component of this is that we really do love moms. It's one of the hardest jobs out there. And oftentimes, especially the moms who work for Paper Source and our customers, are playing both mom and roles outside the home in terms of being breadwinners. And it's a moment of celebration. So we kick this off in March, and it goes right through Mother's Day for us. But it is a constant within Paper Source.
Well, it all sounds really wonderful and very thoughtful and so very important. Right now, there's so much conversation happening about gender equality, so much happening around women and workplace and all of that. Because this has been an issue that's, I think, been top of mind at Paper Source for such a long time, given how much female leadership is there, how are you seeing that change within your organization or for your customers?
Absolutely. I think that 2017 and what has happened in 2017 in terms of the Me Too movement, and that really was a big tip-off for us. It was as simple as a couple of us watching what was happening at the Golden Globes and texting each other and saying, you know what, it's time to speak out and make some noise. But beyond that, I'm really inspired by stories like the women's Olympic hockey team fighting for equal pay and then winning the gold. And so for us, we've always believed in this, but we think it's time to kind of just get our voices out there and mobilize that much more. As a small, mid-sized business that does have a national footprint, we can leverage what we've got in terms of our assets just to provide a platform to celebrate women. And this really is a celebration. And it's really not about any negative sentiment, but it is the positive of everything that we can do for women and this message of empowerment.
a very, very good message, especially that for moms who often carry so much weight of both, you know, breadwinner and domestic responsibility and all that. That's all very, very important. So thank you so much for being with us today. Winnie Park, CEO of Paper Source. And where can people go to connect with Paper Source online and on social media?
Yes, papersource.com. And actually, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and then, of course, visit any one of our stores. And in fact, on March 8th, we will have an activation in store where you can come in and, you know, really show your love of female empowerment, make a sticker, do some crafting, and join us in celebrating.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking time out of your day to talk with us.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Thanks. All right. We are going to take a little break and be back in just a bit here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Minute, sharing the news and asking questions for small business owners. Modern fast food is changing constantly, and one of the more successful companies lately has been Roadie, the fast casual Mediterranean restaurant. They also just received a $23 million investment from Valor Equity Partners here in Chicago. See that, Silicon Valley? We know what we're doing. And speaking of the West Coast, Genivity is heading out there to present at Google Demo Days. The local Chicago startup is focusing on the intersection of health and wealth as they continue to be another success story from Incubator 1871. Let's hope that they can only go up from here. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today and tomorrow. He'll be back with you next week. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your afternoon with me. So right now we're joined by Elise Glink, who you know is a regular contributor to this program, publisher of thinkglink.com and the CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress and then dial it down, reel it in a little bit. You can find out more about that at bestmoneymoves.com. Hi, Elise. Thanks for being with us today.
Nice to be here, Amy.
Always a pleasure to talk with you. So, you know, one topic that is on a lot of people's minds right now, and that is, you know, the struggle of the millennial home buyer getting that down payment together. There's a lot of conversation going around student loans and the moment the millennial generation entered the job market and savings and all that. And so a lot of home buyers seem to be turning to family members to get that home down payment together, but that could come at a cost.
Well, it definitely will come at a cost. It may be emotional, it may be social, it may be the cost of Sunday night dinner, but it may also be financial. So to your point, millennials have come into the workforce figuring out that they have tons of debt. The typical graduate today has almost $38,000 of student loan debt that they're going to be paying off for the next 10 years, or if they convert it, maybe as long as 30 years. And so when you're trying to manage that with getting together enough for money for a down payment, ideally you want 20%, so you don't have to pay private mortgage insurance, that's a really tough haul. And so they're turning to the bank of mom and dad increasingly to get a loan for their house. And as you point out, that comes with some issues. And one of the big issues that both the parents and the children have to think about is, number one, are you going to have some sort of formal documentation of this? Answer should be yes, and we'll talk about that why in a moment. But also, what kind of interest are you going to charge your kids for that loan?
So let's start with that formal documentation.
Right. So, you know, you want to have some sort of notification, letting the world be on notice that you've actually loaned this money. This is if you're the parents. And the reason for doing that is, if something happens to you quite suddenly, then this loan will go against the estate, and the other children in the family or the other heirs that you have will be on notification that this money has come out and is supposed to come back to the estate. If you just give your kid $100,000, the IRS, there could be tax consequences. The IRS will see that as a gift, and you might need documentation to avoid paying a gift tax. And you may also have documentation that you need for the IRS around what kind of interest you're going to charge. Now, the IRS is going to want you to charge what's known as an arm's length transaction interest. So they've got tables at IRS.gov, and it's sort of the minimum of what they would expect in a fair market transaction that you would charge your kid. And then that allows your child to deduct the interest. It allows you to claim it. There's lots of good benefits about that.
Do you get the sense that many people are doing that? I would imagine that the idea or bringing up the idea of charging a family member interest might create some hurt feelings.
Well, you know, then let's talk about what the millennial children are expecting, because I think it's not necessarily fair to go to your parents when you're 28 or 30 years old or 34, because the average age of buying a first house is now almost 34, and say, Mom and Dad, I need 100 grand. Liquidate your 401k for me. It just doesn't seem like a fair thing to ask.
Not at all.
And you know, but if you make it more of a business transaction and you say to your parents, I'm happy to pay you a reasonable rate of interest for that, or parents can say, hey, I'm allowed to give you $15,000 a year tax-free, and I'm happy to contribute that over a period of years. You can set up the loan and then forgive a portion of it as time goes on. There are a lot of ways to do this that are fair to everybody, depending on, you know, people's means. Children don't always have good insight, though, into what their parents actually have, what they own, what they can afford. And this is a great conversation opener for parents and children to really have a honest talk about money.
Right, right. It sounds like it. And it sounds like perhaps really having that transparency, really, really working that through together will probably help perhaps the lender, in this case the parent, feel a little more comfortable treading into what is sometimes emotional and awkward water.
Absolutely. And then, by the way, for your lenders, if you're a borrower, the lender's going to say, hey, I noticed suddenly over the last 3 weeks that $100,000 was deposited in your account. Where did that money come from? And you have to prove to them that you either earned that money, you saved it from somewhere, or if it's a gift, they're going to want to see a gift letter. And you'll need to have a gift letter from the parent or whoever gave you the money saying, I don't expect that to be repaid. Well, parents may not want to put that in writing. And so this is why having these conversations up front is helpful. Now, if you don't want to have that conversation, you can go to a website called downpaymentresource.com. I mention it in my book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask, because I really like what they're doing, and they will dial you right into all the local housing authorities and any free money or free down payment money that's available in local areas.
Excellent.
And it doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, well, there you go. Even better. The price tag is right. Excellent resource as always. Thank you so much for being with us today. Elise Glink, publisher of thinklink.com and the CEO of Best Money Moves. You can find out more at bestmoneymoves.com. Thanks, Elise.
You're welcome. Thanks, Amy.